It's Wednesday, January 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President Barack Obama delivers his final State of the Union address. We'll have reaction.
He's obviously gotten a lot of criticism. In fact, I mean, as of late, that's been really probably the number one issue, number one point of discussion, even beyond jobs and the economy, is the United States' role in foreign policy, the national security of the United States.
The U.S. welcomes a court decision on the Philippines Defense Pact, and Hollywood gets ready for the upcoming Academy Award nominations. It's all ahead. U.S. President Barack Obama delivered his final State of the Union address to a joint session of Congress and the American people late Tuesday and said the State of the Union is strong. The annual speech, broadcast around the world, typically offers a blueprint of a president's policy goals. But in the final year of his presidency, Mr. Obama chose to take a longer view beyond his time in office.
I don't want to just talk about next year. I want to focus on the next 5 years, the next 10 years, and beyond. We live in a time of extraordinary change. Change that's reshaping the way we live, the way we work, our planet, our place in the world. It's change that promises amazing medical breakthroughs, but also economic disruptions that strain working families. It promises education for girls in the most remote villages, but also connects terrorists plotting an ocean away. America's been through big changes before. Wars and depression, the influx of new immigrants. There have been those who told us to fear the future. And each time we overcame those fears, we made change work for us, always extending America's promise outward to the next frontier, to more people. And because we did, because we saw opportunity where others saw peril, we emerged stronger and better than before. Our unique strengths as a nation, our optimism and work ethic, our spirit of discovery, our diversity, our commitment to rule of law, these things give us everything we need to ensure prosperity and security for generations to come.
Mr. Obama lauded what he called the strongest, most durable economy in the world, but called on lawmakers to improve economic security for Americans. He vowed to make the pursuit of terrorist networks that threaten Americans' foreign policy priority number one, while calling for a smarter approach to global problems that mobilizes the world to work together to solve them. And Mr. Obama appealed for less division in American political debate, warning democracy grinds to a halt without a willingness to compromise. Political analyst and associate editor Jeffrey Skelling of the Sabato Crystal Ball at the University of Virginia tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the political divisions Mr. Obama spoke about were clearly evident during the speech.
To some degree, you saw the polarization that exists in American politics today. I mean, for most of the applause line, you know, it was only Democrats standing. And despite what the president was talking about and his hopes and wishes for the country to sort of work together better, to have, you know, less divisions in our politics, the reality of the situation is that we live in a very polarized, divided time. So I think that the optics did reflect that. And in terms of focus, that sort of stuck out to me was, you know, his defense of what the United States has been doing internationally. He's obviously gotten a lot of criticism. In fact, I mean, as of late, that's been really probably the number one issue. Number one point of discussion, even beyond jobs and the economy, is the United States' role in foreign policy, the national security of the United States, with the threat of terrorism and the growth of ISIS in the Middle East and what the U.S. is doing to address it. And the president was pretty direct, I would say, about defending how he's approached it. And he sort of laid out his thesis, which is, yes, ISIS is dangerous. Yes, these terrorists are awful and, you know, need to be destroyed, and we will pursue them, but they do not pose an existential threat to the United States. And I think he defended that point pretty starkly. And he's got a lot of criticism for that attitude. And obviously, you know, polls show that Americans are very frightened of what's going on in the world today and feel, you know, a terrorist attack could be around the corner. So he was, I think, trying to combat that a bit by showing that this is what I think about it. And I don't know if he succeeded in that, in his goal of, you know, perhaps convincing Americans to perhaps be a little less scared of what's going on. But at the end of the day, he defended what he's been doing.
Anything that will last from the speech? Anything that may be enacted by Congress?
You know, I guess it's possible, you know, some things on criminal justice reform could happen, but it's difficult to see a lot of agreement happening, at least in the short term. Even if there were room for compromise, it's an election year, and that's probably the worst time to try to seek compromise. It's interesting because, you know, the president tried to have something of a hopeful tone, but at times he sounded disappointed in the American people and in Congress. But I think he also tried to strike, you know, a note of we can do better and we will do better in the long run.
And do you expect those divisions that he was referring to likely will continue in his last year?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the president is going to be a focal point of the campaign rhetoric one way or the other. For the eventual Democratic nominee, given the importance of the Obama coalition to Democrats' chances in 2016, you're going to absolutely see the Democratic nominee for president cozy up to Obama on most issues. And whoever the Republican nominee is going to definitely go after the Obama agenda and try to sort of stoke the Republican base to turn out. An easy way of doing that is to go after the president, who they dislike heavily.
That's Jeffrey Skelling of the Sabato Crystal Ball at the University of Virginia. In the opposition Republican response, South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley criticized Mr. Obama's domestic policies for leaving a rising national debt, health care that is less affordable, and cities in chaos. She said the November election offers Americans a chance to turn in a new direction. And now for reaction on social media. I'm joined by International Edition's Olin Akisholu.
Hi, Sarah. A lot of people watched the State of the Union address and got engaged in the conversation last night on social media. Twitter released data analysis during and after the speech about how it played out on its platform. According to Twitter's data, the most tweeted about topics during the State of the Union were number one, foreign affairs, number two, energy and the environment, and number three, the economy. It also says the most tweeted moment during the speech came at the end while President Obama said, "I stand here confident that the State of the Union is strong." Twitter also tracked which three accounts had the top follower growth during the speech. President Obama had the most growth, with both House Speaker Ryan coming in second and Vice President Biden coming in third. Also, the three people who had the most screen time during the speech. The most retweeted State of the Union tweet came from President Obama before his address when he tweeted, "I'm treating this last State of the Union just like my first because I'm still just as hungry. I hope you tune in because it's for you."
Well, did presidential candidates respond on social media during the speech?
Yes, they did. Most of the Republican candidates tweeted out criticisms during and after the speech. At one point, Senator Rand Paul tweeted, "I just yelled, 'You lie,' really loud. Good thing I'm not there." From the Democratic candidates, Hillary Clinton was tweeting out points she agreed on during the speech, and Senator Sanders tweeted out a response afterwards. Twitter also released data for which candidates were the most tweeted about and received the most follower growth during the speech. For both sets of data, Donald Trump came in first, followed by Hillary Clinton and Senator Sanders in third.
Thanks very much, Olin. That's International Edition's Olin Akisholu. In other news, Taiwan will elect a new president and legislature Saturday, and young voters are expected to play a pivotal role in the race. In recent years, young voters have become more politically active and are proud of the island's separate identity. Many are also highly skeptical of the island's economic ties with China. VOA's Bill Ide reports from Taipei.
Zhang Boyu is the legislative election's youngest female candidate and a symbol of Taiwan's politically active youth.
"We believe that younger candidates have their strengths, just as they have their weaknesses, and we are working to convince voters that a 24-year-old can help give them a better life."
Zhang is part of a loose grouping of new parties called the Third Force. Her party isn't cooperating with established political brands such as presidential frontrunner Tsai Ing-wen and the Democratic Progressive Party, or DPP. But Freddie Lim and his new power party is, and could help the DPP win control of the legislature. Lim is the lead singer of the metal band Katonic. His stance, like his party's, is that Taiwan should be recognized as independent.
"In reality, Taiwan is a country. It is just that the international community does not recognize that, And because of domestic, political, and legal reasons, such as the Constitution, that we are constantly in a confusing and awkward state.
Young voters, long at the fringe of Taiwan politics, are more active this year for two reasons, political analysts say. First, because they see few economic benefits from the ruling Kuomintang's policy of fostering closer ties with mainland China. And second, they have a rising sense of Taiwan's native identity.
And so they are ideologically alienated from the KMT's position, and they are economically vulnerable to the situation that the KMT helped bring about.
Outside National Taiwan University, students are hopeful the elections will bring change.
We rely too much on the Chinese market, and perhaps at the same time we have overlooked other markets.
I would hope that the candidates that get elected will focus more on Taiwan's native culture and economy.
Taiwan's young new politicians and voters will get their say in the island's future in Saturday's election. Bill Ide, VOA News, Taipei.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Researchers at Cornell University have made a finding that could lead to new and improved cancer treatments. Studying mice with metastatic prostate cancer, the research team discovered some powerful proteins that seek, attack, and then destroy cancer cells flowing in the bloodstream. The researchers created microscopic bubbles they filled with a protein called tumor necrosis factor-related apoptosis-inducing ligand, or TRAIL for short, and administered doses to the cancer-ridden mice. The TRAIL protein bubbles, which attach themselves to white blood cells, kill tumor cells as they travel through the bloodstream. The researchers found that the TRAIL protein prevents the creation and growth of tumors that can spread to other parts of the body. The treatment not only prevented the secondary tumors from developing, but the research team found that the mice's primary tumors had also shrunk in size. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up on Thursday, the Academy Award nominations will be announced. We'll have a preview. The United States has welcomed a decision by the Supreme Court in the Philippines, which declared a two-year-old security agreement with the United States constitutional. It paves the way for an increased U.S. military presence in the Philippines, even as tensions persist with China over a territorial dispute in the South China Sea. Secretary of State John Kerry and Defense Secretary Ashton Carter met Tuesday in Washington with their Filipino counterparts on the same day the court ruling on the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement, or EDCA, was made public. The first to speak is Mr. Kerry.
Our strategic relationship begins with a very firm pledge that the United States has an ironclad commitment to the security of the Philippines. To that end, we welcome the Philippine Supreme Court's decision that the Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement is consistent with the Philippine Constitution. It's a very important decision. And we look forward to implementing this accord, which will increase the interoperability of our armed forces and contribute to modernization and improve our joint capacity to respond to humanitarian emergencies. Our defense cooperation will always be a priority.
There are many aspects to that security cooperation and that joint umbrella, if you like. One of those is freedom of navigation and freedom of the commons. The United States has indicated our intention to fly, sail, and operate wherever international law allows, whether it be the South China Sea or anywhere else around the world.
The security agreement, signed ahead of a visit to the Philippines by President Obama in 2014, allows U.S. troops to build facilities to store equipment for maritime security and humanitarian and disaster response operations, and comes more than 20 years after the last permanent U.S. base was closed in the Southeast Asian country. Carl Baker of the Hawaii-based Pacific Forum tells International Edition's Victor Beatty anti-American sentiment contributed to the base closures. He says things have since changed.
What's happened is, you know, there's a recognition in the Philippines that China represents a threat, and they've suddenly decided that they should focus a bit more on external defense rather than on internal defense. And it sees a military relationship with the United States as being necessary to actually do that.
How will this agreement be worked out? Will there be joint patrols?
I don't think there will be permanent joint patrols. I suspect what we'll see is we'll see an increase in exercise activity. And really, it's a continuation of what's been going on, even though the agreement, it took a while to get approved. You know, remember, it was originally signed in 2014. And since then, you know, there's been an increase in exercises and things like that. And so I think what we'll see is we'll see an increase in exercises. We'll see larger exercises and more robust exercises involved in maritime security rather than just in internal defense issues.
Is this agreement necessary because the Philippine armed forces are not up to challenging China?
That certainly is part of it. And part of it is to, in fact, build capacity in the Philippines so that they are more prepared to provide maritime defense around the islands.
Will China view this as a provocative action?
I think they viewed the original signing of the EDCA as, I'm not so sure about provocative as much as it is as a challenge to their territorial claims in the South China Sea. So in that sense, provocative, but I think they see it more as a challenge to their claims.
Secretary of State Kerry on Tuesday in Washington said the U.S. has an ironclad commitment to the security of the Philippines. What does he mean by ironclad commitment? Are we obligated under treaty to go to war if the Philippines is attacked?
Yes. I mean, that's the mutual defense treaty. But of course, the devil is in the detail because we've had this disagreement with the Philippines for a long time about the Spratly Islands because what the United States has said in the past is that that mutual defense treaty includes the metropolitan areas of the Philippines, which does not include the contested islands in the Spratly Islands.
That's Carl Baker of the Pacific Forum. China's state-run Xinhua News Agency says the bilateral security agreement will escalate tensions and undermine regional peace and security. It warned Manila will bear the consequences of what it called a stupid move. The Philippines is among several Southeast Asian nations that have protested China's encroachment on disputed islands in the South China Sea, including recent aircraft landings on Fiery Cross Reef, one of seven artificial islands built by China and the Spratlys. Meanwhile, Reuters reports that the Philippines has filed a protest against China's test flights, which have also angered Vietnam and drawn a U.S. protest. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
My name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. This year, like every year, the upcoming Oscar nominations feature thought-provoking films, new talent, and tough competition. VOA's Penelope Pulu has more.
All I had was my boy, and he took him from me, you understand?
The Academy of Arts and Sciences loves quality, big-budget films about real people. The Revenant, by Oscar-winning director Alejandro Iñárritu and cinematographer Emmanuel Lubezki, is partially based on a true account. The film explores family ties and the tenacity of the human spirit in the American frontier. But there is serious competition from other movies.
The Boston priest molested kids in six different parishes over the last 30 years. The church found out about it and did nothing.
Spotlight is a tough and thought-provoking film with excellent dialogue and a riveting cast working with the talented director Tom McCarthy and scriptwriter Josh Singer. The film slowly and methodically unveils how Spotlight, the investigative team of the Boston Globe newspaper, uncovered the massive scandal of child molestation in Boston's Catholic Archdiocese and beyond.
This is not just Boston, it's a whole country, it's a whole world.
Like All the President's Men in 1976, Spotlight is an ode to the power of a free press to expose corruption at the highest levels of power. In The Danish Girl, Oscar-winning filmmaker Tom Hooper turns his lens on the struggle of pioneer transgender painter Einar Wiener as he transitions into Lili Elbe in 1920s Copenhagen. The film highlights the very contemporary dialogue on gender fluidity and sexuality. After his Oscar-winning interpretation as paraplegic Stephen Hawking last year, Eddie Redmayne transforms himself to fragile but brave Lily. His stupendous performance may make him an Oscar winner for 2 years in a row. But Redmayne has to compete, among others, with Leonardo DiCaprio, who plays fur trapper Hugh Glass in The Revenant, and Michael Fassbender as Steve Jobs in Danny Boyle's biopic by the same name. Tough picks, but not as tough as the choices in the leading actress category. Cate Blanchett is a favorite as Carol, an upper-class lesbian housewife in Todd Haynes' romantic drama, Carol, about a love affair between two women in 1950s New York. Still, this may be Brie Larson's year for her role as Ma in the dark film Room.
Jack, listen to me. This is our chance.
Larson plays a young abducted woman who is imprisoned in a windowless room but dedicates her life to her son, a product of rape by her abductor. Larson's powerful interpretation is fueled by her on-screen mother-son chemistry with Jacob Tremblay, who plays 5-year-old Jack. We would be amiss if we didn't mention Adam McKay's sleek dark comedy The Big Short on the housing bubble collapse in the mid-2000s and the cinematic post-apocalyptic epic Mad Max Fury Road by veteran Mad Max director George Miller. Let the Oscar race begin. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
That's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Trafficking in persons or modern slavery is a global multi-billion-dollar criminal enterprise. It destabilizes governments and feeds the corruption that compromises the ability of nations to prosper. It fuels other criminal activities such as trafficking or illicit drugs and gun smuggling. It is one of the means by which terrorists fund their activities. Today, it is estimated that there are more than 20 million victims of trafficking globally. No country in the world is immune from this blight on humanity. The United States is one of the top destination countries for human trafficking, as well as for goods produced using forced labor. This means that if we are to fight this scourge, we must begin at home. 3 years ago, President Barack Obama took a number of steps to strengthen and unify the U.S. government response to modern slavery, beginning with a focus on four priority areas: rule of law, that is, investigation, arrest, and prosecution of traffickers; victim assistance, such as health and trauma services, child welfare, ensuring that no forced labor was used anywhere along the supply chain in the production and delivery of goods and services purchased by the United States government; and public awareness and outreach, making the public aware of the scope and extent of the problem, and training people within the government and the public at large how to identify victims of trafficking. Part of this awareness campaign is the President's annual proclamation of January as National Slavery and Human Trafficking Prevention Month. Our intelligence teams have devoted more resources to identifying trafficking networks, law enforcement officers have been working to dismantle those networks, and prosecutors have striven to punish traffickers, said President Obama in this year's proclamation. We have also enhanced our domestic protection so foreign-born workers better understand their rights. To address the underlying conditions that enable human trafficking in the first place, the United States is promoting development and economic growth across the globe, said President Obama. As we work to end human trafficking here in the United States, we will continue to lead the effort to root it out around the world.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.